Here's like this. This will be 2 EQ1 to EK2 times the volume of space squared. The two factors just come from the fact that we would need to use the commutation relations twice, each time getting a factor of 2 EK times the volume. And similarly, the final states have n factors like this, 2 E K J times the volume. So all of these factors are divergent, but as you can see, most, although there's going to be a lot of cancellation. So we've got lots of factors of the volume in both the numerator and denominator. And so most of those will cancel off. So we combine our results, dp, differential probability. We can write as, I'll define this factor in a second, at the matrix element, Im squared times the time. There's only one factor of time, and it's in the numerator. Then we also have 2 EK1, 2 EK2 times the volume. In the denominator, we also have an additional factors of n plus 1 factors of the volume in the denominator. And in the numerator, we have here n factors of the volume and one more from FSI squared. So we've got n plus 1 factors of the volume in the numerator, 2 here and n here. So all but one cancel off. We've got n plus 1 in the numerator, n plus 2 in the denominator. We're just left with this one here. One factor of the volume, one factor of the time. And d phi is everything else I didn't write. And this factor is known as the phase space. So this contains all the information about the integrals over the final momenta. Yes.
Where did the expression for the transfer matrix come from?
This line here, relating it to M. So I just argued that the probability or amplitude should be zero for any scattering process that doesn't conserve energy and momentum. So we expect there should be some factor that enforces energy and momentum conservation. We'll see this will come out of our calculations, but we expect it should be there just based on general principles. This will show up explicitly when we do the computations.
And about the volume there, before it was the volume of space, right?
Yes.
And you use the L cubed argument. But here it's the volume of space-time, I think, right? Because
Volume is always the volume of space. This is a four-dimensional delta, it's the only place. I wrote that as the volume of space times the time. You can imagine making time periodic as well.
Oh.
So your time is periodic too. And in just a moment, we'll take, we'll see that all those factors cancel and we can take the limit where the periodicity goes to infinity. Okay, so this is our probability. What we're actually interested in computing is the differential cross-section, which has additional factors of volume and time, which fortunately exactly cancel off factors of volume and time we have in our probability. So our differential cross-section is just our phase space times Im squared over 2EK1 2EK2 times V, or V is the relative velocity. So this, and together with this, are our key results for the cross section. So we've succeeded in relating the cross section to amplitudes, which is what we want. So this is what we'll learn how to compute later. But we've succeeded in the first step in this process for computing the observable quantities. Are there any questions on this so far? Sometimes we're interested not in a scattering process, but a decay process, for example, for unstable particle. Yes?
I have a question. What about the, there, when we got the square of the bracket of the S matrix with F and I, right, the initial final states?
Yes.
We got a delta squared, right?
Yes.
What happened to the delta squared in the final expression we got for the BC?
So it's, I put it here, it's in the phase space. So this d for of the sum of p, that's just a shorthand for the sum over the final momentum minus the sum over the initial momentum.
Yeah, but it should be squared, right?
So we rewrote one of the factors. So as we can think of it as delta of the sum over the momenta times delta of zero, because if the momenta is not conserved, then the delta is zero. So, and we're interpreting that delta of zero as the volume of space time.
I'm a bit confused about that notation in I bracket I. Is that going to be K1 and K2? EK1 and EK2?
Yes. This is, so I'm assuming that our initial state is a two particle momentum eigenstate. So I is K1, K2. Which is AK1 dagger, AK2 dagger, depending on the vacuum. And if we use the, so in order to compute II, we would need to use the commutation relations twice.
And eventually that will be K1, K2, right? That's what I'm saying.
There's a subscript missing, yes. Okay. So for decay rates, not very much changes. So for a decay process, we're interested in an initial state with just a single particle, and it decays because it's unstable to some number of final particles. So in general, unstable particles can decay in multiple different ways. For example, a tau particle can decay to a muon in neutrinos, or an electron in neutrinos, or a number of other ways. And the computation we've done so far assumes we're interested in the evolution of some initial state to some given final state. So the quantity that we can compute in almost exactly the same way as we did the cross-section is what's known as a partial decay rate. So a total decay rate would be the related to how long the lifetime of some unstable particle, one over the lifetime of the unstable particle. But we can think of the total decay rate as a sum over the possible decay channels of the partial decay rates. So for example, partial decay rate could tell you how quickly a tau particle decays to a muon and two neutrinos, which is not the same as what's the lifetime of a particle. We need to know do the computation of the partial decay rate over all the decay channels in order to compute the lifetime. But this is the easier quantity to compute because partial decay rates involves a fixed final state, which makes it easier to deal with. And very little changes compared to the previous case.
Is that tau measured in the experiment?
You could imagine.
So
you can imagine measuring tau, or you could imagine measuring the partial decay rate. So you could look at, if you have some unstable particles, you could measure them at some time and ask what fraction of them are still there later, in which case you're measuring the lifetime. Or you could start with some particles and ask, how long do I have to wait until it decays to this particular combination of particles, in which case you're measuring this. So both can be measured. And so the differential partial decay width is related to the probability of decay divided by time. So it's basically the only thing that changes compared to our previous computation is we have a slightly different relationship between the probability and the observable of interest. And we have one particle in our initial state. So those two things change, but very little else does. So the differential partial decay width should just be the same phase space. Phase space just contain the information about the final particle, so nothing changes there, times Im squared. And the main difference is that we only have a factor of 2ek because there's only one initial particle, not two. And there's no factor of the relative velocity in this formula, so we don't have a v either. But otherwise, the derivation is essentially the same as what we just did. OK.
So why do we have the dp over t?
So this is a decay rate, so it should be related to the probability of decay in some time interval. So these quantities have different units. We need to have a t there in order to make this equation make exponential sense.
Okay. Here in DeFi, are we going to put in, say, if you want like a particular set of p's, p1, p2, p3 maybe?
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to put that particular measure in.
That's right.
For the particular partial decay we are looking at.
Exactly, yes. OK, so yes, and if we were interested in computing instead of a differential decay width or a differential cross-section, we would just have to integrate over the phase space. And sometimes occurs that we have identical particles in the final state. And if that occurs, we have to be careful not to double count. So you can either divide by a symmetry factor or just be sure to restrict your phase space so you're not double counting. Note that it's, so if they're identical particles in the final state, you either restrict d phi or divide by a symmetry factor. Note that there are two distinct uses of the term symmetry factor in quantum field theory. This is going to be completely different from the one we're going to talk about in a few lectures and next week. So this symmetry factor comes from not overcounting identical particles in the final state. We're going to see a distinct use of this term in a few lectures. Just be aware. They're different. Okay. So we can often actually do quite a bit better than this, than these formulas. We can simplify these formulas quite a bit if we only have a few particles in the final state. We can actually do a lot of the integrals, the phase space integrals, without any knowledge of a matrix element. And that's because we have a delta in the phase space. So simplest, just to illustrate the idea, let's look at the simplest possible case where we've got two massless particles in the final state. In that case, the phase space, which I'll write as d by 2, 2 indicating two final particles, is just a special case of what we considered before. And this is a Lorentz invariant expression. So we've got a four-dimensional Lorentz invariant delta. We've got two copies of our Lorentz invariant measure. So we can evaluate this in any frame. And in practice, it's almost always easiest to do the last part of the computation of the cross-section at a k-rate in the center of mass frame. So we're free to work in any frame we like because it's Lorentz invariant. In the center mass frame, that means that the sum of means k1 plus k2, the three vectors, is 0. And k1 naught plus k2 naught is the center mass energy. And we can use the spatial deltas to do three of these integrals. So we can use it, for example, to do the P2 integrals. And what we're left with, most of the factors of 2 pi cancel off. Get a factor of 2 pi squared, 2e p1, 2e p2. And we're left with a delta EP1 EP2 minus ECM. And P1 integrals and evaluated where P1 is equal to minus P2. You need P1 to equal minus P2 in order for momentum to be, free momentum to be conserved. So if we're dealing with massless particles, that means that EP1 is equal to the magnitude of the three momentum, is equal to the magnitude of the three momentum of particle two by, because we're in the center of mass frame. So EP1 is equal to EP2. Because we're dealing with massless particles.
Yes. The line with dV2, is dV2 equals all the rest? Or the integral of dV2 is?
It equals, yes. Thank you. And so we can then go to spherical coordinates because we've got this relationship between the energy and the magnitude of the three momentum. So it'll make it easier to do the last integral. We've got this 1 over 16 pi squared. P1 squared, so all of the energies are equal to P1. That's the integral of this. Measure comes P1 squared dP1 d omega. And we're left with a delta of 2 P1 minus ECM. And so we can use this delta to do the last integral. These factors of P1 cancel out. This is a delta of 2p, so we get a factor of a half doing that integral. Remember, delta of f of x, sum over xi. Minus x minus xi over the absolute value derivatives. So this gives us a factor of a half when we do this integral. So we get just d integral d omega over 32 pi squared.
So that factor of half is the symmetry factor?
The factor of half is the f prime evaluated at 0. So your x is p1. And so the derivative of f is 2.
So in this case, is that the symmetry factor? Or do we put in the symmetry factor by hand because
so this
two identical massless particles?
So I haven't here specified whether the final particles are identical or not. So if they were identical, we would have to include another factor of half. If they weren't, then we would not need to include that. And so this abbreviation, this relation is often abbreviated just as d phi 2. Is equal to d omega over 32 pi squared. And that's because this derivation would work if I inserted an arbitrary Lorentz invariant function of p1 and p2 in the integral. We've just used the deltas to do the integrals. So this relationship holds. So this is how we usually write it. This because integral d phi 2 times some arbitrary Lorentz invariant function of p1 and p2 is equal to d omega over 32 pi squared of f p1 p2 evaluated where sum of p is equal to the sum. Okay. That's basically what the deltas do. They force four momenta to be conserved. But other than that, we can do the rest of the integrals without caring about what this function f is. So the assumptions that went into this were just that we have two particles in the final state and they're massless. But we can use this for any theory we like. We made no assumptions about what the matrix element looks like. So just want to show you an example of how we can compute a cross section. I'll just give you the matrix element. We haven't learned how to compute that yet. That's something we're going to discuss starting tomorrow. But this is the theory. So I'll be specific and give an example of a specific theory that we're going to come back to later in the course. So the theory we'll be studying, I've chosen for our example today and that we'll come back to later, is a toy model for the scattering of mesons and nucleons. So here we've got one complex scalar field. And the free complex scalar field is going to be something we're going to study in tutorial this afternoon. And a real scalar field. So this is just like the scalar field we looked at on Tuesday. And as well as an interaction term. And I'm going to assume these particles are both massless, so I'm not going to add a mass term in the notes. I include a mass term that resolves a problem we'll see at the end. But for now, for just algebraic simplicity, I'm going to consider these particles to be massless. So this is a scalar nucleon. It's a scalar field, which means it has spin zero. Real nucleons have spin half. Gong will make this theory a bit more realistic and tell you how to include spin in her half of the course. But for simplicity, we're going to look at this toy model where we've got a scalar nucleon that interacts with some meson. So mesons are scalar particles. So this part of the theory is okay. And there's some interaction here. It says that two nucleons can interact with one meson. So one process that can occur, we can have two nucleons scatter into two nucleons. And the matrix element if the initial nucleons have momenta k1 and k2, and the final nucleons have momenta p1 and p2. Is at leading order in perturbation theory, just minus ij squared I over k1 minus p1 squared plus I epsilon I for k1 minus p2 squared plus I epsilon. And this is something we'll learn how to compute in a few lectures. Okay. So let's suppose we're interested in computing the cross section given this matrix element. So the differential cross section is just a half because we have identical particles in the final state times d phi 2 times this matrix element squared 2e k1 2e k2. And if we want to compute this, it's generally easiest to work in the center of mass frame. So in the center of mass frame, k1 is e times k. E and k, k2 is e minus k. P1 is e and p. And P2 is E minus P. The energy has to be the same for the initial and final particles because they're all massless. All identical particles. And because they're massless particles, V equals 2. In the center of mass frame, the particles are moving away from each other at the speed of light. So if the V is 2. Not saying that they're moving away. Yeah. So V can be anywhere between 0 and 2. So you can have two particles moving in opposite directions at the speed of light. And in order to compute this cross section, we need to relate this matrix element, which involves k1 and p1 and k2 and p2, to the angles. We've already simplified our phase space integral to an integral over the angles. So here, and assume that angle between p and k is theta. And so we need to simplify to write k1 minus p1 squared in terms of e and this angle. Now k1 squared and p1 squared are both 0. Because particles are massless. So the only term that survives here is a k1 dot p1, which is equal to e squared minus k dot p, which is equal to e squared times 1 minus cosine of theta, because k and p both have a magnitude of e. And similarly, k1 dot p2 is e squared times 1 plus the cosine squared of theta. Okay, so using those results, we can simplify im squared. That's g to the fourth times 1 over k1 minus p1 squared, 1 over k1 minus p2 squared, which is g to the fourth. The only terms that survive are the k1 dot p1. So we've got here a 1 over 4 k1 dot p1. Sorry, 2 minus 2 and a 1 over minus 2 k1 dot p2 and g to the fourth. So we can then substitute in our results from before. Both of these involve a e squared. This is squared. So we've got e to the fourth. 1 over 1 minus cosine squared theta plus 1 over 1 plus cosine squared theta. And write as g to the fourth for 4 e to the fourth. 2 over 1 minus cosine 4 theta squared. And
where is the cos squared?
This came from giving cosine, sorry.
Are k1 and k2? Because you start a process with k1 and k2, but then you only end up with k4. So
that comes from this matrix element. It turns out, I haven't told you how to calculate this. We will learn how to calculate this early next week. But it turns out it only involves k1 and k2. It's secretly symmetric, but the easiest way to write it is not manifestly symmetric.
So that im has been written in the central mass frame?
This is Lorentz invariant.
Okay.
So this only involves, so this is just a number. This just involves 4 vector squared and a 4 vector squared.
Right, but like there's no dependence on k2? In the scattering cost.
This is the simplest way to write it. It doesn't look like it's symmetric under k1 and k2, but well, the momentum's conserved, so the allowed values for p1 and p2 will depend on k2. So there's some hidden k2 dependence there. And so that's as much simplification we can do for the matrix element. And that gives us then the differential cross section, d sigma d omega, which is sometimes an important observable on its own. You can, instead of just asking what's the cross section for some process to occur, you can look at the angular distribution of the particles that result after the collision. And so that gives, can often give more information than just the total cross section. And that is equal to g to the fourth over 512 pi squared, 1 over 1 minus cosine squared theta squared. And for this case, this is actually as far as we can go. This is not, you see here, there's a singularity when cosine of theta is 1, and it's not integrable. So when theta equals 0, there's a divergence here. And this is related to the presence of massless particles in the theory. One way to understand where this comes from, it's not something we're going to go into a lot of detail in, but just illustrates the general point that only things that are really observable we should expect to be finite. So if we have massless particles in our theory, it's very, very hard to detect a arbitrarily low momentum massless particle. And have arbitrarily low energy, arbitrarily low momentum, and detectors have finite resolution. So if it's a small enough energy, then it's going to be missed by the detector. And so to get a finite result for this calculation with massless particles, we need to account for, one way to think about it is we need to account for finite detector resolution. That no longer becomes an issue if we have massive particles, then the cross-section is something we can observe. And in the notes, I included a mass in this calculation. It makes algebra quite a bit messier, but you can see that you get a finite result. This is just an illustration of how to do the last step in the computation. And where we'll go starting next time is how to compute IM. That'll take us about 2 lectures to go through. Are there any questions on that example? Or anything from earlier in the lecture? Yes.
I'm just wondering, so I epsilon part there, where does that go under the
okay, so what this means, this is a shorthand notation for the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of this thing.
Oh, okay.
So we'll come back to this.
Okay.
This is related to this object here. So at the end, when we compute this, we're going to see that this called the propagator will involve a function. It's like 1 over the momentum squared plus an I epsilon. And then that'll be a result of our calculation we'll see next week.
All right.